mainly to help them load it from short-term memory to long-term.
To go from short-term memory to long-term memory. Okay. And does it work?
Helps.
It helps. I have a homework assignment for everyone.
I'm leaving.
You just lost one.
Since we're associated with the school, I figured this is an appropriate thing to do. A homework assignment for everybody, including Stephanie. Yes, we all hate homework. And who knows what percentage of you will do it. And if you don't, I suppose we could fail you.
Just take away our salvation.
Take away your salvation. There we go. We'll sell indulgences there somewhere. All right. So, your homework assignment. It's an essay. So, in one page or less, I would appreciate it if you would bring back a statement, could be a sentence, can be a paragraph, whatever is appropriate. And the question is simply this. Are the festivals of Leviticus 23 applicable to us today? Yes or no? And you're welcome to argue either one. State, I do not think they are, and then state why. No. I want the why. The why is what I care about. And if you think they do, that's fine too. So it's a short assignment. And for the students who are arriving late in the classroom, they get to So here's the assignment for next week. Homework. Homework is to bring back a short sentence, paragraph, whatever's appropriate for you. Couple paragraphs as you need. Statement is why the festivals apply to us today, or if they do not apply, why do they not apply, and why are they not important? That's the homework assignment. And as Stephanie says, your salvation is dependent upon this if you don't do your homework. Full Stephanie's That's your homework. All right. Jennifer, could you put up our 490 slide? Let's see if this works. Hey, there we go. All right. Didn't break my pointer. Hopefully you can see that. This is the prophecy of Daniel chapter 9. This is the traditional interpretation as is taught by Adventism and by almost every Christian church. So let's explain what we're seeing on the screen. The blue line at the top is the decree to restore and build Jerusalem. That decree, hey, cool, thank you. All right, so we have a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. That decree was issued by either Cyrus or one of the Artaxerxes. By the way, keep in mind, Artaxerxes is used in multiple ways. Artaxerxes is both the name of an individual, but it's also a title. It's like saying president, king. So Artaxerxes is both used as a name, and it's also used as a title. So at some point in time in history, a decree was issued by a Persian ruler to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now, Daniel chapter 9 says there shall be 77s, and then things happen. So from that time and 77s later. So what most every church does in the world is they say, all right, we're going to refer to Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6. And Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6 says, one day is as a year to the Lord. And so we say, well, this Bible verse is talking about 490 days, and therefore 490 years. So we go from 490 years in history, and if we do that, we end up at Jesus. That's the idea. So basically what we do is we start that blue line at the top, and in Daniel chapter 9, it tells us there will be seven sevens, and then there will be 62 sevens. If we add those together, we end up with 69 sevens, which equals 483. 483 years from the time in which one of these decrees was issued until the time that Jesus starts his ministry. That is what we all teach as our church. So if you talk to any of the Bible scholars, they'll tell you there's a little bit of a question about how this works. Question number one is, what year was the decree issued, and who was it that issued the decree? Many of us know the story of Cyrus. So let's go back and do a little bit of history about Cyrus. Who is Cyrus? Cyrus happens to be a very successful conqueror. First of all, he persuades all the Medes, the Median, which are basically Persians, which are basically Iranians, and he persuades them he should be their king. Well, there happens to be a much more powerful empire in place called the Assyrians. Cyrus knocks out the Assyrians and puts himself in place. And he also wages war, and he defeats the Persians as well. And he then decides to wage war on Babylon. So in reality, for 20 years, Cyrus is the king of the Medes. 20 years later, he manages to defeat the Persians, and he's now king of the Medes and the Persians. 20 years later, he wages war on the Babylonians and succeeds, and now he is the king of the Medes, the Persians, the Babylonians, the Syrians, the Egyptians, the Edomites, the Judeans, and a whole bunch of other people. Conquers them all. Cyrus is considered the great because he has been so militarily successful. The story about how he defeats the Babylonians is interesting. The story is recorded in the Bible. There's more to it than that as well. It's a fascinating story. The year after Cyrus defeats the Babylonians, keep in mind that there's a bunch of Jews in Babylon, and these Jews are high-ranking officials in the Babylonian Empire. Daniel happens to be one of the very top. As soon as Cyrus takes over Babylon, the Jews rush up to him and says, "Hey, guess what? We found your name in one of our scrolls, and it talks about you." He says, "Oh yeah, right, show me." So he tells them to go pull out the archives. They're showing the archives. Pull out the scroll, and lo and behold, there it says, "Hey, Cyrus, you by name, you're going to be doing something nice for all these Jews." Well, I guess if it says it, I guess I better do it. And so he issues a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. What year did he issue that decree? Do we know? The year is not 457. The years in which he conquered it, and that year is pretty well recorded. It happens to be 539. So, if we use the year 539 to start that blue line, we do not end up with Jesus. So, that means it's not Cyrus who issued the decree. So then we go to the next guy who then issued the decree. So what happened when Cyrus issued the decree? When Cyrus issued the decree, a bunch of Jews hopped on their donkeys, mules, and they headed off over to Jerusalem. And they get there. As soon as they get there, they start saying, "Wow, the walls are all broken down, the houses are broken down. We better start patching these." And a bunch of their neighbors sent lobbyists back to Persia, back to Cyrus, and said, "Hey, we don't want these walls to be rebuilt." Well, by that time, Cyrus was gone. He had been replaced by Candace. Canvas was the new leader. And he agreed. No need to build that. We don't need the Jews reporting things. We just have to turn the wall back then next time they rebel. The Jews are known for being extremely rebellious people. Like anybody telling them what to do. All right. So the Jews got a problem. So they go back and start petitioning again. The next person they petition happens to be a guy that we've all heard of. His name is Darius. Darius the Great. So who is Darius? Darius the Great happens to be related to the family of Cyrus. They share a great-great-great-grandfather. And how do we know this? Jennifer, put up on the screen, if you would, Behistun. So Behistun is a mountain in Iran. And if you could drag that stuff on the right, Jennifer, where it's got all the people in the group, if you drag that down to the bottom, we can see the full screen.
Okay.
Or maybe Ron can do that. Okay, so there, the west side of Iran, there happens to be a mountain. It happens to be on the Silk Road. It happens to be near a little town called Behistun. It happens to be on one of the primary roads. So one of the major accomplishments of the Persian Empire was they were the first ones to invent the Pony Express. And what they've done is they had built a road that had a whole bunch of relay stations, and that road went all the way from the palace of Susa all the way over to Lydia, which happens to be on the west coast of Turkey. So almost all the way over to where the churches of Revelation are talked about. And there was a nice 2,000 mile long road, and along that road, they established a number of commissaries, which were basically relay stations for messages, and you could get a message from one side of the empire to the from the middle of the empire to one side of the empire in about 10 days. Pretty impressive. Darius Darush, by the way, is the name that's pronounced in Persian, in ancient Persian. His name is pronounced Darush. Anyway, Darush has established all that. Along that road happens to be a little town of Behistun, and in Behistun there happens to be a mountain. And on that mountain, Darius decided, you know, I think I'm going to make a record of my accomplishments. So scroll up or scroll down as appropriate and show us the inscription that he has. So there on the left-hand side is a picture of the mountain, and you can't really see it very well there. And up close, you can see this inscription that is chiseled into the rock. That inscription happens to be 50 feet high, 80 feet wide, and it's 300 feet up in the mountain. So the only way to get to it is basically use a couple of ropes and climb your way up there. It's not an easy place to get. Obviously, Darush put it there because he didn't want anybody to deface it. He wanted it to stay there for a long time. And so this happens to be it. That inscription is written in three different languages. It's pretty much like the Rosetta Stone. It is the equivalent of the Rosetta Stone. That inscription is written by Darush. Basically, it is written in Old Persian. It is written in Babylonian, and it is written in Edomite. That says, I am King Darush. I'm King of Kings. I'm King of Assyria. I'm King of Egypt. I'm King of, and he lists this long list of things he's done. All of those guys that you kind of see there, they got let's see if we can use my little point. That guy right there is Darush. Darius, we call him today. And he's got his foot on a guy laying down here. And then he's got a whole bunch of guys which have got a rope around their neck and are his prisoners. And these are all the names of the people that he's captured. And down at the bottom and in the inscription, he gives the name of each of these guys. In this inscription, he also happens to say who his father is, who his grandfather is, and who his great-grandfather is, and how he's related related to Cyrus. He goes through and gives a genealogy of his family tree, and he also happens to tell us the order in which the various rulers of the region served. Virtually everything we know about who served when and in what year they did comes from that map. Now, there have been a whole lot of cuneiform tablets that have also been found, which give us a lot more insight as well. But this is the basis for most of what we know. That happens to have been lost for many, many centuries. People were aware it was there, but nobody paid attention to it. And for a long time, it became misattributed as to who it was that carved it and who had put it there. It wasn't until the Germans decided that they were going to go and figure it out. And the Germans decided to send a survey team in to take a look at it. And they worked on it, and then World War II happened. And then somebody decided it would be fun to use it as target practice. And so there's a bunch of bullet holes in the inscriptions. So there's a couple of words in this due to bullets. Those guys should be shot. Anyway, it wasn't until the British, actually, the British Museum, ended up doing a lot of research. They went in, they made casts of it, they sent it back, and people, because it was Persian, old Persian, it wasn't the same as today's Persian by any means, it was old Persian, and through that, they were able to decipher it. So, this is how we learn much of what we know about who served what, when, and where. Let's go back to our 490 graph. By the way, if you want to go read about Behistun, it's spelled B-E-H-I-S-T-U-N. It's an interesting story. So, who was it that issued the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? If we wanted to get to Jesus, it can't be Cyrus. Who was it?
Well, I think I challenged that assumption.
Okay.
It couldn't be Cyrus. So, we know that there were several decrees issued in a similar zip code time frame. And the reason I think Cyrus may have some validity, one is it's when the decree is issued. It's not when the work starts or suspend it or restart it or they start to travel, you know, there or whatnot. But I know scripture talks a lot about Satan was trying, in my opinion, Satan was trying to influence Cyrus not to do that because it's going to screw up all the Bible prophecy.
Okay.
And it sounds like it was a battle of galactic proportion because my interpretation is as Christ gets involved and tells Cyrus, no, you know, you need to do this. And the decree, you know, was issued, which I, you know, I think at least Adventist theologians will say, well, that is around 457 when that decree, you know, was issued. So I think there may be some, only because Christ is so involved in the conflict of Cyrus's decree. I don't know if it diminishes other decrees or adds weight to Cyrus's decree, but it's clear he issued a decree, you know, for that. So.
It is true. It is very clear he issued a decree. So, all right, let's go back a little bit further in history then. All right, so Babylon, the empire is beginning to crumble. And the Egyptians decide to revolt. Jeremiah issues a prophecy to the king of Judea saying, you need to stay with Babylon because Babylon is going to be victorious. And the king says, I don't know, we're getting tired of paying taxes to the Babylonians and I kind of like the Egyptians better. Jeremiah says, don't you dare side with the Egyptians, because if you do, you're going to be punished by God. The king, of course, sides with the Egyptians. It's just the way stories work like this. So he sides with the Egyptians. The Babylonians send an army in. They go and crush Egypt, destroy it. Egypt can put it back under their control. Egypt is, by the way, the primary breadbasket that is supplying the food. If you go back, these clay tablets tell you how much food they have to supply. They are the primary supplier of the entire region. I mean, that continued for millennia. They supplied not only the Babylonian Empire, they supplied the Persian Empire, they supplied the Roman Empire. Egypt was the primary food supplier of the entire region for millennia. As soon as They conquered Egypt. Nebuchadnezzar turns around and goes to Jerusalem. He said, you picked the wrong side, guys. And the first temple was destroyed. Jeremiah says, you are going to be sent to Babylon, and you're going to be captives for 70 years. For 70 years, you are going to be captives held in Babylon. Daniel is one of the people who is taken to Babylon. Daniel is praying, and the prayer that we find in Daniel chapter 8 is a prayer about this prophecy by Jeremiah. And this prophecy said, look, Lord, I know that we are getting close to the end of the 70 years as prophesied by Jeremiah. It's still 3 years away. 30 years from now, I need to start praying today because I know 30 years from now we're going to be released. So Daniel is praying during the 70-year prophecy of Jeremiah. And what he's doing is he's praying about that prophecy, saying, Lord, look, for your sake, not for ours, because we're not worthy, but for your sake, you said at the end of 70 years, we will be released and taken back to Jerusalem. Please, Lord, for your sake, honor this prayer. This is the prayer in which Gabriel is sent to Daniel and has given them a dream of Daniel chapter 8. Daniel says, I don't understand. Doesn't make sense. Gabriel is sent to interpret the dream. And it still says, I don't understand. A little bit later, the angel Gabriel is sent a second time. And this is where he says, I was fighting with the prince of Persia. The angel who's defending that and making it difficult. That's the context of this prayer. And in this prayer, Daniel says, I need to understand. This is the prayer in which Gabriel gives the prophecy that we're looking at here. Gabriel is saying, look, 77 is a decree for your people. It's in response to the 70-year prophecy of Jeremiah. They're talking about two different 70s. So the first 70 is the one given by Jeremiah. It's the one in which they're in Babylon, and it's the one which Daniel is praying about. And the game, Gabriel comes and gives not the answer to prophecy of Jeremiah, but it gives him a new prophecy. It gives him a new story. And that's the context in which we're looking at. Now, when did Cyrus live? Cyrus lived in 539. That's when he took, well, he lived for many years, 4 years and a half. One of the years in which he lived, and he took control of Babylon. And the story is told in Daniel. He lived in 539. That is recorded on lots and lots of different clay tablets, and it is basically undisputed. Even Christian, even Adventist theologians will agree, Cyrus lived in approximately 539. Now, Cyrus definitely did give a decree to return Jerusalem. 539 is the proper year to use. So, all of you who are good at math, take 539 minus 483 or 490, whichever number you want, and where do we end up at? So, take, who's good at math? 539 minus 483.
And where do we get the date 457 from?
All right. Let's do the math real quick and then we'll answer.
56.
What was the number?
56.
56. So we ended up at 56 BC. Okay? So 56 BC is where we ended up at, which is obviously 50 years before Christ starts his ministry.
So we cannot use the decree of Cyrus if we want to end up at Jesus. So one of the two things has to happen. Either this prophecy doesn't apply to Jesus, or we have to use a different date, or we have to decide that all the clay tablets and all the history is wrong about the date. One or the other. Now, I will tell you, I have a very long history of challenging teachers on dates. So I'm perfectly happy to challenge history teachers on dates. Just to give you a short, brief story. When I was in fifth grade, my teacher is teaching evolution. And my teacher says that we are going to have a test. And on the test, I'm supposed to write how old such and such a rocks are. Some paleontic age or how old, what this question was. Anyway, I'm supposed to write it down. So what I do is I know what the answer is that the teacher wants. So I write on it. The book says 25 million years or 100 million years, whatever the number was. I don't think it was. The book says 100 million years. Teacher gets it. Wrong. Well, the number was right. What she was objecting to was the book says. Because what I was doing is to say, I understand that I know what the answer you want is, but I reject your answer as being factual and correct. The teacher, and this was in fifth grade in a tiny little rural school, far away from civilization, and the teacher failed me on that. So I have a long history of being willing to challenge dates. I'm pretty sure 539 is right. All right, so how do we get to 457?
Before you jump into that, so this mountain, you know, wasn't really started to be understood until the 1940s or the late 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the war, it's kind of when it was deciphered. How much of that mountain confirms various dates, various ideas of dates, which would not have been accessible to our early church fathers?
So the mountain does not have dates on it. What it does have is the names of the various kings that preceded Darush and give their genealogy and who they're related to and etc. So that's the primary benefit of that mountain inscription. It gives us the names of the different empires and who were the parties. He goes through and talks about his, not only his father and his grandfather and great-grandfather, but it also gives the Median side of the Medes side of the genealogy and how they were in place. Goes through and says their various names, etc., how long some of them reigned. So he said, you know, Smerdis, for example, Pseudo Smerdis, which happens to be the fake guy who pretended to be Cyrus, and he lived for, what was it, less than a year, ended up being murdered. So he tells some of that history, all you won't find it. And that's how we know much of that. But there is nothing on there that says 539, there's nothing that says it, because that dating system didn't exist. The way the dating system worked at the time, and you find it throughout the Bible, was such and such a king ruled from such and such a time. So we're dating it from King Darius in his third year, his sixth year, his fifth year. So as long as you know when that king was, you're good. So the way we end up knowing dates is we simply start tracing who ruled what, when, etc., and how long did they rule. And that's how historians put together the dates. Now, for some, we have a lot of clay tablets. There's a lot of information about Cyrus. Why? Well, because he was extremely successful. Two, probably because he took the sledgehammer and smashed everybody else's clay tablets. That's the way history works. Right now, Biden's going through and smashing everything Trump did. Trump, when he was president, went through and smashed everything Obama did. It's just the way humans are. And so, the successful ones, the ones which happen to be militarily the strongest, end up getting to write history. That's what we tend to know. So there's a lot about Cyrus. There's a lot about Darius. There is entire warehouses full of clay tablets found and deciphered based on those two primary people. So, the way we get to 457 is this. We read the book of Ezra, And in the book of Ezra, we have a story about these decrees. Ezra happened to be the cupbearer. And along with Ezra happened to be six guards of the gate. And the names of those guards happens to be given. The names of their fathers happens to be given. So we have the genealogy there. First is that, skip over the genealogy. Number one, I don't know how to pronounce the names. Number two, what the purpose is, doesn't matter. What's interesting though, is if you go through, we have, as Mike said, there are decrees by multiple people. There are decrees by Cyrus. There's another repeated decree by Darius. There happens to be a repeated decree by Artaxerxes. Keep in mind, Artaxerxes is a title. It's also a name. There's more than one Artaxerxes. There are multiple Artaxerxes. Darius calls himself Artaxerxes. So as we go through and we take a look at that, we've got Artaxerxes the first, we got Artaxerxes the second, we got Artaxerxes the third, fourth, fifth, sixth. Cyrus issues the decree, Darius comes along and issues the decree a second time. He happens to give that decree. And when he gives that decree, he not only provides them with just the authorization, but he also includes with it the instructions to supply Zerubbabel with all of the building materials that he needs. Well, we know what years Darius lived based on the wealth of information that's there. But Darius didn't live in 457 either. He died before that. So we go to one of the Artaxerxes. We happen to go to Artaxerxes Longimanus. Artaxerxes Longimanus happens to have been 60 years later. And we choose to use the decree issued by Artaxerxes Longimanus. In order to do that, we use the book of Ezra to make that statement. And we're saying that the Ezra, who happens to have been alive at the time of Cyrus, is the same Ezra, or not the same Ezra, as the one who lived in Artaxerxes on the main slip. So, doing the math, you can come along, and what you discover is that in order for us to get to 457, we as Christian theologians choose to insert 60 years between chapter 6 of Ezra and chapter 7 of Ezra. And we age Ezra to the age of 140. So that's a problem, because nobody lives to be 140 years of age. And so we decide that the Ezra who wrote the book of Ezra is not the same Ezra as the one who was a contemporary of Nehemiah. We decide that the Ezra who wrote the book of Ezra is either a son or a grandson of the Ezra who's a contemporary of Nehemiah. Now, this is the historical Adventist. It's not just Adventist, it's all of Christianity teaches this. So this is not an Adventist concept. This is taught by every Christian theologian that's out there, virtually all. Except for, of course, Dr. Andrew Rios, which happens to be an Adventist, who says there's a problem, that's a serious problem. But his complaint isn't with the 457. His complaint instead is that the way it's worded in Daniel 9 is it says there will be seven sevens. Then the appointed one comes, and then there will be 62 sevens. So according to Andre Rees and many others, this right here, at the end of the 49 years, the end of the seven sevens, there should be an event that happens then. There should be the event being anointed one comes. So by the way, to answer your question, right? 457 comes from us choosing to use AD 27 is the start date, and then going back to the year we need to get it to work, and that year happens to be 457. And so therefore we find a decree that happened in 457, or we invent one, and we choose to invent a decree by Artaxerxes Longinus. That's how we get to it. It's not just Adams, all Christians in those days.
Here's another worthless fact for you.
Okay.
Isaiah 45:1. Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I held. Well, I think probably Cyrus is the only non-Jew that is referred to as anointed by anybody. So I think that gives weight, you know, to Cyrus, you know, as well.
I don't dispute that Cyrus was given that command. That is most certainly true. Okay. The question is, what year did Cyrus live?
I would argue that Wikipedia is from 600 to 539. So.
Right. There's the challenge. So everything that historians, secular historians have found, including many Christian theologians, say that Cyrus lived long before 457. So we all agree, Cyrus issued that decree. He issued it 30 years before the 70-year prophecy of Jeremiah was expired. So God says, Jeremiah, the Jews are going to be captives from Babylon for 70 years. 30 years before that period is up, Cyrus issues the decree to restore Jerusalem. Well, if you're going to be captive for 70 years, why are you getting us out early? And that's the history. So I agree, Cyrus issued the decree. Isaiah is clear. It is the Isaiah passage which the Jews read to Cyrus, and it's which persuaded him to give that decree. The problem is, if we use that decree, which we can and we should, we do not end up at AD 27.
Yeah, but using that reasoning that the other end of the dating spectrum is like, okay, well, that's when Christ was baptized. What if his ministry was clay pots, water, and wine, or what if it was when he was born, or what, you know.
Right, so this right here is, this red one, Jesus starts his ministry, is the clay pots turning to water.
What about his baptism? Wasn't that the AD 27?
Happened the same year.
Oh, it is, okay.
Right, so in AD 27, we believe, when we pick a year, I mean, it could be AD 26, 25, 27, whatever it be, but somewhere in that close to the vicinity, Jesus starts his ministry, and he starts the ministry turning water to wine at Cana, and that happens to be the same year in which he's baptized. We think. If it not, it's within 6 months.
Yeah, but Adventist other theologians can say, no, his ministry really started when he turned 18, when he started healing people, when he started
preaching. Or we can go back to when he was, we can go back to when he was born. Problem is, we're still off. Always. So one of two things either has to happen. Either Cyrus didn't live in 539. That's not the correct year. That's one option. Another option is that our calendar off by 60 years. We shouldn't be in the year 2021. We should be 60 years earlier than we are now. Another possibility is that this prophecy is not about Jesus. Another possibility is that it wasn't Cyrus the one that we should use for the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, but rather one of his successors. Those are our options. I mean, which one?
We really think that if it was not that Cyrus, but a different king, that it would still be called Cyrus? I mean, it seems like that's pretty specific. And he was given, I think, about 150 years before Cyrus was even born. And I read some stuff by Josephus that some people realized that, and everybody started naming their baby Cyrus.
By the way, there happens to be a Cyrus that's high in American government right now. His name is Cyrus Vance II. His father used to be the Secretary of State, so he was responsible for doing all of our international relations. His son happens to be someone I think you should keep an eye on. Because it wouldn't surprise me if some other day Cyrus II, Cyrus the Vance II, happens to get promoted to some important position. Right now, he happens to be the Attorney General of the State of New York. And he happens to be the one currently pulling all of Trump's tax records and prosecuting. But he is, in my opinion, got a star that you should probably keep an eye on just because of his name. Who knows? There may be another day and opportunity in which a Cyrus will play an important role. My purpose is not to destroy your faith in historical interpretation. That's not my purpose. What my purpose is to give you an understanding of what it is, how it works, and what its challenges are. It has given faith and hope to millions of people. It has persuaded a very large number of people that Jesus is the promised Messiah. It has served its purpose. It's important. This is something which virtually every evangelistic series talks about and teaches. Millions of people have come to God because of this understanding.
Well, I think probably the Adventist. So using that methodology, then let's jump to 1844. Mm-hmm. Does that mean, well, that was not a significant date in theology?
So you're correct. It definitely hinges on this thought right here.
So using, all right, so William Miller is studying his Bible. He's a Baptist. He's not an Adventist. He's a Baptist. He's studying his Bible. He's reading these prophecies of Daniel 8, 9, 10, etc. And as he's reading them, he comes across the passage in Daniel chapter 8, which says, here's all these things that are going to happen. And at the end of them, the sanctuary will be restored. Well, William Miller didn't know his festivals. And so he said, sometime during 1843, don't know what day, but sometime during the year 1843, Jesus is coming again. And he bases it off of this prophecy, and bases it off of this decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. And based on that prophecy, he says, doing my math, we get to 1843. 1843 comes and goes. There is no Jesus. Everybody's discouraged. Everybody says, well, I must have had it wrong. William Miller and two others sit around and say, what did we do wrong? This looks so clear, so plain. Huh, I forgot to count the years ago. Must be 1844. Uh-huh. Okay, we're good. We got it. And then, as we talked about several weeks ago, there's a guy named Snow who came along and said, not only is it 1844, but it happens to be associated. What day is the temple restored? It's restored on the Day of Atonement, right? That's Snow's understanding and interpretation. And Snow, who was an atheist 4 years prior, had become a Christian because of William Miller, said, okay, Day of Atonement. Well, what day is the Day of Atonement? I don't know. Anybody around here know? No, we don't know. Well, who would know? Well, the Jews, they know. Okay, let's go ask the Jews. So Snow goes over to the Jewish congregation, the synagogue there, and said, when is the Day of Atonement? He said, well, 1843 was a 13-month year. And so in 1844, the Day of Atonement is going to be later than normal. It will be on October 22nd. So Snow publishes a tract describing in detail how Jesus will return on the Day of Atonement on October 22nd. He based it off of festivals. That tract went far and wide and persuaded a very large number of people that they should sell their belongings and put all of their hope and faith on October 22nd, 1843, or 44. It's based on the understanding that Artaxerxes Longinus gave the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, which we better go off. Not Cyrus, but Artaxerxes. Fourth decree to give. That's what most of Christian chooses to use. Right or wrong. I understand the argument for Cyrus, but that's what they chose. So Adventist doctrine, theology, or church came out and grew out of that disappointment from 1844. That's the history of it. So this entire concept is the foundation for our church, and it is a primary proof for most of Christianity that Jesus is the promised Messiah of Daniel chapter 9. It's why it is the most famous prophecy, the most referred to prophecy in the Bible. Its challenge is two things. One, what year was the 490 degree started? It was 457. The second challenge is, what's it? Why is this 7 sevens and 62 sevens split? Virtually all of Christianity ignores the split here and why it exists.
I'm sorry, walk me through how you get to 1844 from here.
Okay, so all of this graph that we're looking at here is related to the 490 years, days, etc. How do we get to 1844? William Miller says, well, we need to start our 2300 evenings and mornings. So I don't have that chart and graph up here. But he's in Daniel chapter 8, verse 14, it says, so Daniel's doing this prayer, and he's talking about this prayer that he is, or a vision that he's been given in response to his prayer about being refreed from the Babylonian captivity. So it's all tied together. So that vision that Daniel has is a vision of a goat and a ram, and there's horns, and they have this fight in the sky, and horns get broken, and Daniel says, I don't understand. The angel comes along and says, all right, here's the understanding. I'm going to give you the interpretation of the vision. And here's the interpretation. Here's all the things that are going to happen. And Daniel says, okay, how long is it going to be until this temple gets restored? This is just, okay, I don't tell me the end of the story. I don't like what's happening in between. Tell me the end. And the angel says, well, or maybe it's not the angel. Whoever it was tells him. Until 2300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be restored. So William Miller says, all right, we're going to go from 457, and we're going to go one year per day. So 2300 from 457, we got to go past, so it's 457 pre-Christ, and then lo and behold, if we do the 2300, we end up at 1843. That's how we get there. So that's how William Miller got there. And that's how he got 10% of the American population to come to one of his evangelistic series saying Jesus is coming again. It made sense to a large number of people.
So it starts at the same 478.
It does.
That's the time.
Okay. So that's how we got to 1844. That's the history of it. Obviously, as we know, 1844, Jesus didn't come as they expected. And so once again, there was great disappointment, and a large number of people left the William Millerite movement. And the few who remained then sat around and tried to say, okay, what did we get wrong? And what they decided that they got wrong, of course, wasn't that Jesus was going to come in 1844, but rather that Jesus was going to move from one role in the sanctuary to another role in the sanctuary. He would go from being a ministering priest in the holy place to the ministering high priest in the most holy place. That was the Adventist explanation, and the Adventist church was founded based on that concept. Again, it's all based on custom. As I say, there are two challenges with it. I'm not saying that they're wrong. I'm simply saying there are things which we should understand and discuss. Challenge number one, the year 457. Challenge number two is, why is there this division of seven sevens and 62 sevens, and why does the Bible say that the anointed one comes after the seven sevens, not the 69? Those are the two biggest challenges.
Wasn't because he said he was cut off in the middle of the week.
So, what we typically do as Christians is there's one of several things that we do. And this is what, there's a tremendous amount of discussion in Christendom about how we're going to do that. So, up here at the top, we've got Jesus' ministry starts at AD 27, and then we got the green where he dies in AD 31. So, in verse, what is it, 26 or 27, we have seven sevens, and in the middle of the week, the anointed, or excuse me, someone is cut off. So, much of Christianity chooses to put that as Jesus, and that he was cut off in AD 31. And then we still have another half of a week in which to do something with it. So what ends up happening 3.5 years later? Find something. We'll just make one up. Let's make it Stephen being stone. Nobody knows what year Stephen was actually stone. We chose it as Christians because we needed a close to the 77s. Nonetheless, that's what we, this is what's taught by everybody. So those are our challenges. Now, as you guys know, I choose to ignore this debate.
Last week.
There's nothing, I mean, I understand the issues, I know what the issues are, I understand how it's benefited Christendom, I understand how it's brought millions of people to the church. It is a good thing. There are some challenges with it. I know the challenges, I know the possible answers to it. And I also think it doesn't matter. The reason I think it doesn't matter is because it's history. It was good for the people of 1844. It was good for everybody from 1844 to today. It taught us a lot of stuff. It brought a lot of people to the church. That's a good thing. Do we care about what the problems are? I do, but nobody else does.
Well, I don't know if it's a salvation issue. I mean, it's interesting history. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it goes back to, you know, your thoughts are not my thoughts. And no one knows the time and the hour and things anyway. So
let me ask you this. Will we ever know the day and the hour?
When it happens, yeah.
Will we know it before?
I don't know.
I'll give you another white coat sometime.
Okay.
No one knows the day again.
And yet Ellen White says we will be told the day and the hour before it comes.
Yeah, but doesn't it say that even Jesus says no, only God does?
It does say that. So there, Jennifer and I have been reading a lot about Jewish practices and rituals and etc. And by the way, no one knows the day and the hour happens to be tied to Jewish weddings. It's a common phrase associated with Jewish weddings. And it's an interesting story. But that's a totally different subject.
So you're saying this, you know, was a this understanding of these time prophecies were important stepping stones, you know, to bring people to faith and to get people through this time of disappointment, which was also great. Growth and learning of Christianity, but has a, it's not the stopping point. It's just a, there's another understanding of this that will take us to the next step.
That's what I'm arguing. I'm saying knowing all this information is good, but we should not walk ourselves into the box that says this is the one and only understanding and say that it should be done with it. I think if we choose to say, this is the one and only way in which we can understand things, I think we create a problem for ourselves.
Well, that's true of every religion. There's pride of authorship, but there's enough scripture that says that there's going to be new life.
Agreed.
I don't know when that is, but I think what, you know, what we believed 200 years ago is probably slightly different based on events that have happened, prophecy that's been fulfilled, and I think that will continue probably. So.
I think it's important for us as Adventists, especially since our church is effectively founded on this concept right here. This is a part of that foundation. I think it's important for us to understand the historical understanding. I think it's important for us to know what's good about it. I think it's important for us to know what the challenges are. I think it's important for us to know how to answer some of those challenges. We haven't talked about how to answer the challenges today. I've instead given you the challenges. That's fine.
My understanding of our founders, they would have been very uncomfortable locking themselves into this understanding forever. They had a foundational concept of truth, that God continues to reveal truth as it's needed. And they lived that out in some very interesting ways, one of which was they refused to write down a set of beliefs and make it a standard for membership for many, many, many years. And that's a hard thing to do for a group. Like, you have to define your group in some way. How do you define it with flexible definitions? Well, they tried. And so I think this, looking at new applications of this, would have been a very acceptable thing for our founders to do.
I agree. I would have run a lot of history, and I find that this prophecy is one which is important to our faith. I think it's important that we understand it, and it's been a very, very helpful in prophecy. As I said, virtually every Adventist evangelistic series will reference this.
Not just Adventist.
Yeah, it's on the side, it's correct. That's true. I did go to a Baptist evangelistic series one time. Listen to that. And there's a lot of similarity between the Baptist evangelistic series and the Adventist evangelistic series. Of course, I went as an Adventist and Baptist and listened to what they had to say, but I was too young to be foolish enough to ask questions. It's probably time's up today, but I want to give you the historical understanding.
Fascinating history lesson and stimulating, discussion. That's one thing I appreciate about Protestant religions in general is, we do have a healthy debate on the scriptures. It's not like Catholicism where, well, the Pope is infallible. I think our church founders realized that this is what they thought, but might not be. So.
Just something to stick in your thinking process. Who was it that told David and Solomon to build the first temple? There's a decree in the Bible that gives us that answer.
It was David who came up with the idea, but God says, no, you got blood on your hands, so I have to give some.
Correct. And so God, Jesus, comes along and says, exactly that. David, I want you and your son, David, you put all the stuff in place. Solomon, I want you to build me a temple. The first decree for the first temple came from God, directly himself. Did you know that there happens to be a decree from God to build the second temple?
Teaser.
By the way, you all have a homework assignment. And for those of you who missed the homework assignment, you got here in time to get the homework assignment. So you have a homework assignment. The homework assignment is on a piece of paper. Please bring that piece of paper next week, or don't show up. And on that piece of paper, bring with you a statement as to why you think the festivals apply or do not apply to us today. That's your assignment. You can use a sentence, a paragraph, whatever's necessary. Explain why, in your opinion, they apply or do not apply to us today.
Is that an assessment that you want to make, how much you have convinced us over the past?
So the teachers tell me that the reason that they give homework assignments is to cause, well, maybe I'll let you put it in your own words. What is the reason for homework?
One reason for homework is to help your memory, move things from short-term memory to long-term memory. So there are other reasons for homework.
So the reason I am asking this question is simply because I think it causes each of us to sit down and say, okay, what are my reasons? And if I have to explain myself with something other than I just don't know or I don't want to think about it, it causes me to think about it. I think that's good for us. If you decide that they do not apply, that's okay. Explain why. And you've got several reasons I can give you. One, they were nailed to the cross. Two, they were for the Jews only. Three, I just don't like killing animals. I don't think we should ever have to kill animals again. That's your reason. That's fine. Whatever your reason be, simply write out a piece of paper and bring it with you. We'll talk about it.
Probably need at least 500 words.
Take just a couple of minutes here. Stretch, move around, get some fresh air.